Goblins by Nick Petrou. Elodie palmed her face. She'd been listening to Cullen argue with the village reeve for 20 minutes, and Cullen had just tried to raise the bounty after they'd already shaken hands. Black snow blanketed the fields. The air reeked of rotten eggs and green leaves burning. Several peasants, cheekbones sharp, eyes seemingly thumbed into their skulls, watched the argument from their sunken homes. "As you said, good sir," said Cullen, "the Lord of the Manor is off at war, so it's 3 silver pieces per ear, or slay the goblins yourself." Elodie could hear the reeve's teeth grinding as he spoke. "Look about you. The soot chokes our crop. Goblins take what little livestock we have left. We have no more to give." Cullen raised his chin. "Then good day to you." The weight of the world seemed to collapse upon the reeve, and Elodie felt it trying to drag her down too. But this was the way of things. She sighed. 2 will do. Cullen scowled at her, his pupils wreathed in mage flame, then took one hand from his robe and extended it to the reeve. "We'll be back for our silver before sundown." The reeve battered Cullen's hand away, then stomped off, grunting, "Deal," without looking back. Cullen bumped Elodie's shoulder as he passed her. "What? You want to starve too?" Elodie strung her bow, then followed him out of the village. It had been difficult to find the goblins' tracks under the snow, but once Elodie had a rough direction, Cullen struggled to keep up with her. So far, the hunt had taken them through the thin buffer of trees surrounding the village and up the face of a hill littered with granite outcrops. Climbing an outcrop on the crest of the hill, Elodie's stomach sunk as though she'd eaten a toadstool, thinking it was a mushroom. The sky was uniformly grey, except where it met the Iron City, whose silhouetted chimneys spewed inky fumes into a yellowish thundercloud. But worse than the pollution was the forest spanning the vast distance between Elodie and the city, a forest of tree stumps. She could even, with her keen ears, hear the thuds of freshly cut trees as they struck the earth. Scowling, she leapt down and resumed the hunt. By the time the sun, little more than a smear of pale light behind the clouds, was nearing the crown of the sky, the pair had arrived at a broad, snow-filled gully, which Elodie now surveyed from some bushes at the top of the gully's east bank. Cullen, conserving his magic, squatted in a nearby rock shelter, teeth clattering so loud that Elodie was afraid the goblins would hear him. There were 3 of them. One standing just inside a jagged cave mouth in an outcrop protruding from the gully's west bank. One patrolling the gully, and another hiding somewhere inside the bank beneath Elodie. She could smell him. While she wished she could reason with the creatures, previous jobs had proven it impossible. She crept back to Cullen, and 10 minutes later, they were in position, bow drawn, flame dancing upon Cullen's palm. A broadhead sunk through the first goblin's eye, and he toppled out of the cave mouth. Cullen, who'd snuck into the gully downwind, pushed his magic through his arteries towards his palm, which he aimed at the second goblin, melting him from the neck down to a green sludge that boiled through the snow. And as the third goblin poked his head out of his hiding place, Elodie put an arrow through it. While Cullen was cutting the ears from the goblin by the cave mouth, Elodie inspected the creature, noting that his hooked nose and pointed chin were much more pronounced than she'd come to expect of their kind. Lifting the animal pelts which covered the goblin's torso, she saw that his ribs protruded too. So potent was the stench wafting out of the cave that Elodie feared Cullen's flame would incite an explosion. But they went in anyway, Elodie's eyes quickly adjusting to the relative dark. The stench worsened as they progressed. Cullen vomited as silently as he could, and even Elodie gagged. Her muscles were as taut as vile strings, but no ambush came. A minute later, she froze, Cullen almost tripping into her. She shut her eyes and listened, hearing what sounded like coughing and mewling from somewhere ahead. The tunnel split, but Elodie followed her ears, and when she felt she was but a stone's throw from whatever was making those sounds and smells, she signaled for Cullen to wait. Creeping ahead on her own, she approached the entrance of a cavern, where she clung to the shadows and nearly wept as she absorbed the scene in front of her. Goblin mothers and children were curled around fires, shadows accentuating their emaciated, shivering forms. There were no adult males. Skewered on a roasting spit over one fire was the body of a goblin child. Another child was expelling watery excrement by a mound of dung in the corner. They were starving, dying, and by no fault of their own. Elodie envisioned the forest of tree stumps, their source of food, life, destroyed, and fought to suppress the primal rage swelling inside of her. She crept back to Cullen and started shoving him out of the cave. When they were back under the polluted sky, she ripped Cullen's sack of goblin ears from his belt and tossed it aside. "What was that for?" he half shouted, half whispered. Elodie grabbed him by the collar. "Forget the silver." Cullen failed to wriggle free. "You won't be saying that when we can't afford food." Elodie thrust him away and started across the gully. "Where are you going?" he called. "We'll find some other way," she said without stopping. Cullen picked up the sack of goblin ears. "There isn't one, shy of raiding the city itself." With that, Elodie smiled. The end. Hello kids, welcome to episode 2 of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Paddy, a podcast created by my writing partner Nick Petru and I, Patrick McCarthy, where we'll be immersing ourselves in the world of the written word and attempting to be as entertaining and as smart-ass as possible. Before we commence, we'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which we meet, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and pay respect to their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city, this region, and their leaders, past, present, and emerging. How the fuck are you, Nick?
Not bad, mate. Actually, a little bit rolled over by my rolling up for the COVID vac. But other than that, feeling pretty good, man. Again, we've got our whiskey, so I can't complain too much.
Yeah, man. Like, COVIDed up, but pissed. Yeah, man. Yeah, a lot of people have been saying it knackers you a wee bit, hey? Your second one, hey?
Yup.
Yeah, I've still got my first one coming next week.
Enjoy that. You can choose to put it in your butt, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Just ask them real
Ask the nurse when you go in there, or just pull your Dax down.
Just look over my shoulder at them. Please.
So what did you think of that story?
I liked it, actually, man. I did like it a lot. It was, like, quite atmospheric. I like the descriptions of, like, the, you know, how smoggy and polluted it is, and, like, the sort of completely cut down swaths of forest. And it builds to this, like, sort of apocalyptic vision of, I guess, like a race, like a people whose culture and lifestyle or livelihood is completely decimated by the actions of the protagonist, yeah. Which I thought was quite cool. And wasn't that like a, because you wrote that for a magazine, right?
I wrote it for an online publication. It was a competition with a theme of hunger for a speculative magazine called The Arcanist. They usually take stories up to 1,000 words, so it's like purely a flash fiction market.
Mm.
I've been trying to crack that one for a while, and you know, that was a few months back now, but I won first place with that, and it was just awesome. Nice. Yeah, I felt so good. It was like it's probably the biggest win I've had so far with, you know, submitting stories. So, yeah, really happy with that. So the hunger theme I brought into it, obviously, with the starving goblins and the starving villagers at the start. So when Cullen and Elodie are talking to the Reeve, that village isn't doing so well as the goblins. Mm. And essentially what I was thinking is, like, rather than just having, like, starving goblins and then they're going out of their way to, you know, attack the villagers because they need the food, I was like, I wanted to add another layer to it. So I was like, what's in people's minds at the moment and environmental stuff, like the current environmental crisis, which everyone seems to have forgotten about.
The world fuckage.
Yeah. And I was like, that's kind of like relevant. So I introduced that element to it and I justified like why they would be starving, why they would be going out of their way to attack people. So it's not just like the mindless creatures committing evil, like they were kind of forced into it. And at the end, I, you know, had it so Elodie kind of recognizes that and changes her trajectory because of it. You know, maybe she's got a little bit more empathy than the traditional adventurer would.
Mm. Yeah, oath. Yeah, you can tell there was like a socioeconomic edge to it. Everyone sort of has some relative degree of fuck all.
Yeah.
And they're vying for whatever, what little resources they have.
Yeah.
And then in the background, there's this, like this huge specter, the Iron City, polluting everything, ravaging the environment for its like natural resources, and everyone's feeling it, including the protagonist and the goblins and Hunter. I could tell you were fucking watching The Wire at the time you were reading it.
I actually was at the same time. It's funny.
It does sort of like that kind of show does, like, I mean, we're going to talk about it definitely. In that episode for sure.
Yeah.
But it definitely plants those things in your head, like everything's kind of connected and everyone's sort of suffering in some small way and impacting other people's suffering. Yeah, cool, man. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. But I hope you do better next time.
Yeah. You always have to slight me, Patrick.
Well, it's cool. It just gives you the hunger, man. You know, like, it makes you inflamed.
I'm thinking a few people have said to write, like, a part two or continue it because it kind of ends on a little bit. Like, I don't know.
It does, you can. Yeah, you definitely should.
I feel like, you know, the character has changed, so it justifies the story ending in that regard. But there's obviously more to tell. But again, 1,000 words, there's only so much you can do. I felt I already crammed, like, a quest into 1,000 words, which was a bloody nightmare. Like, like every single word I was picking and choosing so carefully, like...
Which is what you want to do, yeah.
Contracting words and hyphenating things and just, like, doing everything I could to just keep under that 1,000-word limit, hey?
How many does it have? How many words? Do you know?
It's, like, on 1,000.
Oh, yeah, it's like exactly 1,000. Yeah, nice. Yeah. And you won as well. It's wicked. Nicely done.
Thanks, man.
That's cool. Yeah.
We'll probably, share some other stories that I've had accepted to publications. It just depends on, like, when the rights revert to me. So they, like, you know, retain it for 3 months, 6 months, sometimes a year. And after that period, like, I can do whatever I want with it. Like, it's still always my story, but I can't go sharing it elsewhere.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
And it sort counts like as
for now.
Yeah. It counts as, like, a reprint. Even us, like, narrating that story now counts as it being reprinted. It's published again.
Ooh.
Yeah.
In My Short Life by Patrick McCarthy. In my short life, I have seen some things. Joyous winters, painful springs, gigantic moths with blood-red wings, homeless kids paid bread to sing while their mothers played the banjo. In my short life, I have done some stuff. Yacked in a mosque, I felt so rough. Drank snake venom shots till I'd had enough. Wrestled a Vietnamese man whilst in the buff, and then shouted his family some pho. In my short life, I have seen some shit. 12 dead camels buried in a pit. An arseless man who couldn't sit. A lady playing the flute with her clit because she'd misplaced her oboe. In my short life, it's been easy to find many things that blow my mind, like scuba diving round wartime mines, or a shaman racking me some lines. Fed a hippo melon rinds, paid a soothsayer to read my mind, she divined from the bones of a crow. In my short life, from near to far, I have experienced much that soothed my scars. Some jungle astronomer pointed out Mars, watched some 10-year-olds hotwire a car, heard a drunken blind man spit fat bars, made ferocious love beneath desert stars, and swilled blue moonshine brewed in massive jars, which made me shite myself in the snow. In my short life, I've done all I can to fit a lot into a small lifespan. Got a uni degree, then my troubles began. Fled to Africa when I was barely a man. Bought beer for this dude from Turkmenistan, who knocked me out with a frying pan. Then drove into the sand in his shitty three-wheeled van. Sold hashish I stole from an Algerian man. Played S&M with a beauty called Anne and sucked the dick of a nice lad named Dan. Egged a US embassy, then fucking ran. Gave CPR to a junkie called Stan. Got loopy on tabs and insulted my nan, and then laughed at death like only gods can. Yeah. Crashing through life without a plan has without a doubt made me the man I am. Now I'm back at home, where it all began, and I've still got so much left to do. The end.
Well, I'm flabbergasted. I don't know how much of that was true or not, and I think I would prefer not knowing, actually.
Yeah. I kind of sort of wrote it by design in that regard. I've had a really mad life. So a lot of it is true, but a lot of it is complete fiction, which has been really fun for friends and family to try and decipher. Yeah, so I was just, I turned 27, and it was an amazing birthday, and I just felt very, very at peace with the age I was, and I was looking back on all the amazing experiences I've had, and the people that have come into my life, and the opportunities I've had and enjoyed, and I just thought writing a very lunatic, strange, like kaleidoscopic poem about that, like, you know, verse and rude and a bit risque. I always love that kind of stuff. You know?
I think it's probably about time that we give parents a little disclaimer. We're going to be using a fair bit of profanity here. Like, this show is probably not for kids.
Well, I'm going to be showing it to my little niece like next week, and she's 3 going on 13, and she's more than old enough to hear me say minge.
So one thing I wanted to ask you about that poem is, like, you deviate from the rhyme structure every now and then, and it seems to be for comedic value. Like, it's always pretty funny when you do that. There was the one about you, like, shitting yourself in the snow or something like that. Why did you do that?
I like the idea of building to climaxes, and I probably talked about it in the last episode. I like, the sort of concept of like a unity. So I have like a rhyming scheme. Like, I'll have, every line of the poem would rhyme with the line after it and so on until I decide when to add the refrain, which always ends with that O sound, banjo. Shit myself in the snow.
I didn't know that.
And I've still got so much left to do, or divine from the bones of a crow.
Sick.
So I wanted that to be a unifying refrain to give it structure and consistency, and it would be like a punchline. You could, end it with a statement that puts everything else in new perspective.
Yeah.
Or it can end on like a punchline, like a joke, like the moonshine segment. But everything else has a unified rhyme scheme to give it a flow and a consistency. It like dances and dances and dances towards the climax, which I thought it was really fun to write. Like, it was really fun. It was a pain in the ass because, you know, and you had to change names or change scenarios to fit like rhyme schemes. Like, for example, the last stanza with everything rhyming with that and sound.
Yeah.
Like, into a small lifespan, got a uni degree, then my troubles began, Turkmenistan, frying pan, etc.
Yeah.
You manipulate real events ever so slightly just to fit your needs, and it's absolutely fine because it goes with the theme of the poem. I just wanted something completely nonsensical and absurd.
Yeah.
But heaps of truth in it. You know, like, I really am stoked when I look back on my life. I'm 27 and hopefully, fingers crossed, I've got like 2 more left of everything I've already experienced to go.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, I'd be stoked with 81 as the time to fucking shuffle off. I think
it
would be a
fucking miracle if you make it to 81, bro.
Well, thanks, sir. I appreciate that, man. I'm going to try my best. But I'm just, my life's been very fun, you know, very lucky in a lot of respects.
It's definitely evident. It's nice to have something a little more lighthearted in this show as well, because I keep calling it a show. I guess it's kind of like a radio show. Isn't that what a podcast is?
Yeah, this is our show.
Yeah,
that's what we call it, a show. Yeah. Podcast just sounds like we're a couple of twats talking in a dark room with whiskey. Doing. No, we're not. We're in a studio.
So a lot of the stuff that we've covered so far has been pretty dark. like the first story, Bronze and Hazel, and even Goblins was darker than I remember it. So it's good to...
It's because you're grim as fuck.
I guess I am, hey. I want to just bring people's spirits up a little bit, you know, level it out again.
Oh, we have dimensions, ladies and gentlemen, we do.
Fair warning, dear listeners, we're about to spoil the 2015 horror film, The Witch.
In this episode segment on Stories We Love, we want to talk about one of our favourite films, 2015's supernatural horror, The Witch. In his directorial debut, Robert Eggers tells the story of Thomason, the eldest daughter of a 17th century Puritan family. Ousted from their religious community, forced to create a life for themselves on the border of a dense and forbidding forest, Thomason and her loved ones fall prey to a witch of the wood, a twisted creature hell-bent on using the family to her own malevolent ends. Though rightly acclaimed for its vibrant horror imagery and unsettling historical authenticity, the richest thing about the film is how it perverts the coming-of-age story trope, following the heroine Thomason as she grows from chaste, pious innocence into a corrupted, hellish vision of womanhood. Anya Taylor-Joy plays Thomason in her big screen debut as a young girl on the cusp of adulthood. Her devoutly religious upbringing has instilled in her a sense of purity and virtuousness. But after a brush with the witch sees her baby brother snatched away, never to be seen again, these aspects of her character are slowly but surely shed forever. Any and all reverence for her family's way of life gives way to the malignant influence of the witch, and as she changes from chaste to sensual, from weak to strong, from shackled to free, Thomason grows into a woman before our very eyes, eventually becoming a witch herself.
Her garments fastened to her throat, coif suppressing her hair, Thomason's appearance at the outset of the film is childlike. But as the story progresses, her tight clothes and hair unfasten to the point where her revealed skin and womanly figure entices her own brother, Caleb. Thomason's mother, her faith and psyche unraveling, views Thomason innocently tending to her father, removing his shirt to wash it and cleaning his clothes, as a move to seduce him. Later, when the mother is truly unhinged, she outright accuses Thomason of bewitching her brother like a whore, and meaning to bewitch her father next.
Introduced as a fresh-faced, rosy-cheeked kid, Thomason's gradual grip on her own power initially takes form when she intimidates her younger sister, Mercy. Mercy playfully accuses her of losing their baby brother on purpose, and so Thomason toys with her sister twistedly in reply, wielding her body and voice as weapons to scare her and making prophetic reference to her dancing naked with the devil. Her parents, once loving, become enraged and frightened by her mere presence, coming to view her as an agent of danger and sin. Once her family's destroyed, with only Thomason and her mother left alive, the women come to blows and Thomason silences her mother with a billhook. She then removes her clean outer garment, representative of her recent Puritan past life, leaving her bloody undergarment on, sitting comfortably in filth.
The wicked witch, unfettered to blind faith, wreaks havoc upon the family of her own free will. Thomason and her loved ones, imprisoned by their puritanical beliefs, are powerless to stop her. As Thomason discovers her sexuality and grows in strength, the story climaxes with her family dead, the belief system it once stood on destroyed. Now with nothing in her way, she no longer fights the devil's seduction and chooses to live deliciously.
Long hair cascading down her naked body, itself stained with blood she readily accepts, Thomason leaves for the woods, the devil at her side. She is now a woman, fully realized, actualized, and willfully a witch.
was episode 2 of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Patty.
It was. Yeah, I had a really nice time. I'm a little bit drunk as well. But, you know, on the whole, I think we talked a moderate amount of shite, which is great. I think that's what we're aiming to do every single episode. So to conclude, Oscar Wilde, Irish playwright, poet and novelist, and a writer I adore. He argued for imagination and openness. He sought no approval for his creations, nor justifications or moral reasons to create. An anarchist who promoted a disregard for authority over him, and he put the value of artistry above anything else, even regarding life as an art form, that one must live beautifully. We're going to close with an excerpt taken from the preface to his famous philosophical gothic novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, which is a book you should read, Nick.
I haven't read it.
It's just beautiful, man. His language is gorgeous. And he has such a verve and, like, love of life.
That character is in Penny Dreadful.
He is indeed. Oh. Yeah, yeah. Very famous.
I just made that connection. Yeah. There you go.
He's a very famous character. And it's a very famous book based on, like, sensual pleasure and hedonism, but ultimately about, like, a love of life. And it's, you know, it's a scary horror story as well, but it's so beautiful.
Excellent.
The book offended the moral sensibilities of the British elite and the public when it was published in the 1890s. He wrote the preface to the book to defend the artist's rights and of art for art's sake, which is a quote attributed to him, based on his own defense of the role in court. He was a closeted homosexual, and he wanted to keep it secret, and this book sort of implicated that to the public, and they wanted to fuck him up for it. The preface itself has become famous in its own right as a literary and artistic manifesto, and the quote we're going to leave you with is, "All art is at once surface and symbol. Those who go beneath the surface do so at their own peril. All art is quite useless."